of snipers in palm trees. And their sabers flash like lightning in the charge of the last brigade. They must have been afraid. Soldiers have their sorrow, the wretched have their rage. Pray for the aged, it's the dawn of another age, of another age.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Kanata. I'm your host, Kevin Annett. With Ryan Gable, my co-host. Welcome back. This is June 14th, and you're listening to bbsradio.com/Radio Free Kanata. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And hello especially to our new group of listeners in England. Quite relevant today that you're listening, because we are going to be talking about Magna Carta, dispelling myths about it and talking about how we can still use it in our struggle to establish sovereignty and the common law in the face of increasing tyranny everywhere. You can follow our work at kanatarepublic.ca, and of course the work of the Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State at itccs.org. A few announcements before we start. Thank you for all of the increasing number of listeners. We've jumped from about 90 listeners in the first show 3 months ago to over 800 now, and so we appreciate the continued support. And to remind folks again, this program does cost us close to, well, over $250 a month to produce. And we don't have government grants or grants from anybody. We rely on what you, the people, allow us to do. And so we need your donations to help keep the show going. Please donate at the PayPal button in the upper right corner right there at itccs.org. Now, some other really important news we have, if you go to that site, itccs.org, you'll notice that the upcoming first Constitutional Convention of the Republic of Kanata has been called for the weekend of October 30th to November 1st in Toronto. That's of this year. And any delegate, any sworn citizen of the Republic can become a delegate with full voice and vote. This is an open convention. We'll have observers from other countries and also observers who aren't necessarily active members yet but are very interested. And so that three-day gathering will formally adopt a constitution for the Republic and elect a Congress to serve as a legitimate provisional government now that the Canadian state is null and void under international law. Now, convention organizing committee has been established. There's going to be six things debated in various position papers, and this convention will also be going on bilingually in both English and French. So we really urge you to all take part in it, to look at a copy of the revised constitution for Kanata and all the position papers. You can follow it at kanatarepublic.ca, but also write to the head office at republicofkanata@gmail.com. Also, in that regard, there's July 1st coming up, and as we all know, this is so-called Dominion of Canada Day, where people are going to get out their silly maple leaves and wave them around. Well, people in across Kanata are going to be having little counter processions. I know some of the folks in Ontario are already planning to walk around with a Kanata flag at the official Canada Day celebrations, but if you in your own community feel like standing there when the official Canada Day stuff is going on, and stand there with various signs like saying things like "Stand down, Crown," "Long live the Republic of Kanata," and "Canada null and void." And of course, list our website, don't forget, at kanatarepublic.ca, to start educating more of the people about what we're all about. Finally, and we'll talk about this today, some of our participants are the London organizers for the Republic, Jonathan and Dan, and they're going to be talking about a new case that they're taking charge of. They are convening a common law court case on one of the themes and concerns that so many of you keep writing to us about, and that is the corrupt taxation agency in Canada known as the Canada Revenue Agency, and which is actively defrauding people across the country. And we are convening a common law court case under the auspices of the Republic to put the CRA on trial and to show how this Crown agency is in fact a criminal body. And so if you want to be part of that, please write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. And also Dan will have his email. I believe it's londondirectactiongroup@gmail.com, but he can confirm that when he's on the air. Okay, that's the announcements. Now let me bring on Ryan. Hi. Hi there, brother. How are you?
I'm doing good today, Kevin. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm sitting here with my grape juice and enjoying the day. It's a beautiful sunny day where I am. How about you?
It's a pretty nice day where I am, too. I just went out and got some vegetables for lunch here, and I'm ready to talk a little bit about history of the Magna Carta. I thought that was a good topic for today, considering it's the anniversary.
That's right. Starting tomorrow is 800 years since the barons at Runnymede forced King John to sign what was quite an amazing document. And let me just give folks a little recap of some history, and then we can bring in the others and have a general discussion about it. Magna Carta means Great Charter in Latin. And, of course, the whole thing was written in Latin. There was 40 copies made. Only four of them survived. Two of those are in the British Library, and the other two are touring the world regularly. The reasons it's important, and it's simple, there's three or four things that it established that nobody else had ever done before. First of all, it used a term called law of the land, or lex terrae, and it referred to the people within England as freemen. And it's kind of ironic that, you know, these days you hear the expression freemen on the land. There's a lot of hysteria being created about it. I think the FBI and the RCMP have both said that freemen on the land are a terrorist organization. They don't say why exactly, but they just create a lot of hype around this term freemen. Well, these are words taken right out of Magna Carta. About five or six times, Magna Carta uses this term freemen. And basically, it means all the people on the land. So these rights within Magna Carta applied to everybody. That's quite an amazing thing because it had never been done before. Secondly, it and the barons who made, at least a faction of them, who made King John sign it, they said that the king was not giving them rights. These liberties pre-exist any king or any document. It's what's called ab initio in Latin. It means not caused by man, they exist just like creation does. And the liberties that pre-exist are simply recognized and affirmed legally. They weren't granted by a king. Now, that's another very important thing because it eventually led, centuries later, with this notion of unalienable liberties. That is, we have these unalienable rights and they're not granted to us by any parliament, king, pope, anybody. So that was a very radical thing for Magna Carta to do. One of the reasons the king signed it when he didn't want to was 7 years prior to Magna Carta, Pope Innocent III, and of course, you know, this had to do with European politics, the war between England and France for who would control both countries, and the papacy, of course, jumping in there like a dirty rag, trying to control the whole thing. Pope Innocent III had tried to impose his own archbishop on England, a guy called Stephen Langton. He was the Pope's man, and the guy wanted him in as Archbishop of Canterbury, and John said no. So Pope Innocent, in March 1208, put the entire country of England under what was called interdict, which is this funny idea that, you know, that suddenly all of you are thrown off into the darkness. You can't have any kind of church ceremony. You can't bury people. You can't baptize them. And that went on for 7 years. So John was under a lot of pressure to do something, and he was up in basically in a civil war with his own barons. So anyway, the whole country was under the control of the papacy, or at least in their mind it was. And so that was some of the stuff that led to Magna Carta. But just I think the general point is that it introduced the notion that all the people, freemen, all the people have rights, and that these rights pre-exist all authority, and it applies to everybody. And there's more that came out of that, but that's kind of the general framework for what Magna Carta is.
Yeah, it gives all men the right to justice, right to a fair trial. And I think by taking that idea of human rights and delegating it to the people from some type of positional authority, whether it be in the political realm or the religious realm, it gives you this notion that since they can give it to you, they can also take it away. So you're always relying on somebody else to determine whether or not you're free and whether or not you have these rights, which is why we look at them as unalienable rights, that we look at everybody as freemen. And you're right, they create a lot of hype around that word or that terminology, freemen on the land, or they also call it the sovereign citizen movement, people that believe that there should be a separation of government within the affairs of the people. They shouldn't have to pay necessarily taxes, these outside corporations that come into the country and just tax people into oblivion. And a lot of that ties in with the crown. But yeah, the Magna Carta is a very important document as it relates to so many other different documents throughout history, the U.S. Bill of Rights, even the European Convention on Human Rights. I mean, the Magna Carta was the basis, the core principles for a lot of these later documents on human rights, why it's so historically important.
Right, and now it's interesting because in England tomorrow, there's this big hype about, of course, it being the 800th anniversary. And apparently the Royal Barge, I guess Queen Elizabeth, so-called, is going to be going down the Thames River on the Royal Barge, leading a procession of 200 little boats down to Runnymede, which is an island in the Thames where the Magna Carta was signed. And it's funny because the government and the Crown have a very different notion of what Magna Carta is. They basically said it was rights granted by the monarch to the, quote, subjects. And so it's funny how, despite what it actually is, the authorities continually try to use it as a way to kind of, you know, refashion the chains around our thinking that somehow these are, we should be so grateful that we were given these things.
Right.
You know, and
they gave them to us, but we should be grateful to them, exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of like when the government issues the apology for mass murder. Oh, we just decided to do that out of the kindness of our hearts. It wasn't because of people occupying churches and exposing their crimes.
Exactly.
You know, it's the same kind of everything is psychological warfare, and Magna Carta is used for that. Let me just quote a couple of things in Magna Carta that are really foundational, because they relate to the next thing we're going to talk about in the show once our other the other folks come on. It relates to how we can use this today in common law courts. Right at the very start of Magna Carta, in the very first article, it says, "We have," this is a direct quote, "we have also granted to all freemen of our realm, for us and our heirs forever, all the underwritten liberties to be had and held by them and their heirs." So it might have been couched in the language of granting, but it says it's for everyone. And no document had ever done that before. You know, in European history. Article 10, it basically says anyone who's in a state of debt shall not be imprisoned or held forever responsible for those debts. So it allows, you know, freedom from debt servitude. Also in Section 39, no freeman shall be taken or imprisoned or exiled or in any way destroyed except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. In other words, that's Article 39, the first statement against arbitrary arrest and imprisonment. And that's been cited many times in court cases. And right after it's Article 40, to no one will we sell, to no one will we refuse or delay right or justice. Habeas corpus, you can't keep somebody in prison indefinitely. You've got to produce them in court, and they've got to be given every right to seek justice. So these things are foundational to everything we call common law, really.
Yeah, and I think that there's a big issue that comes about with language, like you and I always talk about, Kevin, and that is the way that they use certain terminologies and they turn them around and they give people this perceptual idea of what certain words mean as opposed to the actual literal dictionary definition. And, you know, there's a lot of talk nowadays all over the world, especially in Canada and in the United States, about rights that we're talking about today. And if you look at the Magna Carta as the basis of the U.S. Bill of Rights, for example, a lot of kids, because I'm a little bit younger, and I know a lot of kids my age, they don't even know what the Bill of Rights is, they don't know what the Constitution is, and they really have no clue about history, which is why I find history so important, to educate people about the past so we can understand what it's like now in the present. And what I'm finding in my research in the last 6 years and doing my radio show and writing books is that there's been a very, very calculated effort to give people this image that, of course, they have rights, it's been granted by a monarchy, by a government, to get you to be dependent upon that system. And at the same time, then they will obviously break all of those different laws, all of those different legalities that make it seem as if, you know, you are free and you have the right to do this and this, and unless, of course, it infringes upon other people's rights or it's a matter of national security. So what they'll do is they'll say, we're going to be able to, and they do this in America, we're going to be able to arrest American citizens under the National Defense Authorization Act. And people get up in arms about this, and the government says, well, we're not really going to do that because you all have rights, so that's not going to affect you, it's just the terrorists. But then right. What they end up doing is they create this very, very obscure list of different types of activities that can be considered an act of terrorism, such as the FBI has released in America, wearing blue jeans and paying with cash are two signs of potential terrorism. So once you wear a pair of blue jeans, now all of a sudden your rights evaporate.
Right. I wanted to ask, are Dan and Jonathan on the line yet? Are you guys on? Okay. That's really interesting because, I mean, it's part of the, like I say, psychological warfare. You create an image of this ragged guy, you know, without any kind of bourgeois respectability, just this guy slinking around paying with money, you know, doing whatever. Like, it's the fear-mongering. Yeah. And what followed from Magna Carta introduced kind of a germ in the system, and that is nobody is above the law. Even the king has to be subject to the law, and that's the basis on which several hundred years later, when the Republic was established in England in 1649 and they put King Charles on trial, they charged him with tyranny, which is waging a war against the liberties and lives of his own people. And he was found lawfully guilty and executed. And there was this famous statement by the Supreme Court justice in England. It was called the High Court of Justice. A guy, prior to the English Revolution, a guy called Sir Edward Coke, and he said, "Be you ever so high, you are not above the law." That is true for kings or popes. So, I mean, that was a royalist speaking, and yet he said, it doesn't matter what the king does or the pope does, they are subject to the law like any other human being. It doesn't even matter if you think they're semi-godlike. It doesn't matter. They're subject to the law. And that's a very radical notion that the government still have trouble with.
Well, of course, and that's why a lot of these historical documents, such as the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, this has essentially been ejected from the public education system. And then people have this idea that political figures, presidents, prime ministers, popes, that they are above the law, regardless of the actions that they take and regardless of the evidence to suggest the crimes that they've actually committed. And then people have this idea that, well, there's nothing we can do about it. They are essentially God in that respect of how they're viewed, I think.
Well, yeah, it's like there's two spirits. I mean, the spirit behind a small group of people who want to run the world and own everything, and they have to get everybody feeling that they're subject to them in some way. And then there's the other spirit, which is the law of creation, the natural law, which is what Magna Carta enunciated, and that is we are all equal. The term in America is under God. That meant that had a very specific meaning in the American Constitution. It meant we are equal under creation. Nobody is above us. And even when we elect them, we haven't surrendered sovereignty to them. That's a very different notion. There's a guy called Jean-Jacques Rousseau who wrote this thing called The Social Contract around the time of the French Revolution. And it's a very radical book. People should read it because John Locke and Thomas Hobbes were the other philosophers of the modern, you know, kind of liberal state. They said, You need a sovereign, whether it's parliament, government, king, whoever. And once you establish them, you have surrendered everything to them. And they can do whatever they want to you because they're the sovereign. Jean-Jacques Rousseau said, no, bullshit. Even when you establish a sovereign, you retain sovereignty. So you cannot operate under their control if you don't want to. If you withdraw consent, they have no authority over you. And that's
exactly
what
right.
we're talking about. Right. And that's our notion. Go ahead.
I was going to disagree with you and say, and when you put these people into positions of power and you have this notion that they are above the law, that's the image that's been created, but you're exactly right. Once these people are put into these positions of power, you have a right and a responsibility to overthrow them if they begin not acting in your interest for the first reasons that you put them into power in the first place. And, of course, that is another part of this educational problem that I always talk about is that we are not taught that. We are taught that these people are sovereign authorities and that we must listen to them. Or, you know, who knows, you might be labeled a terrorist, have your rights stripped away. Who knows what might happen to you. And then that's part of the fear-mongering, of course.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that because that's exactly what Thomas Jefferson said. And I just happened to be having a copy of the Declaration of Independence in front of me, and it says, besides the obvious, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just consent for powers from the consent of the governed. Now, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form. So, in other words, they're saying, yes, you have the right to revolt. We're not giving you that right. You have that right as a free person. So we are, you know, with everything we're doing with the Republic, we are simply acting on this long precedent of freedom. And, you know, so it's very relevant to a lot of the work we're doing right now.
Yeah, and Kevin, I also wanted to ask you, because this is a question that people ask me a lot, and I can see the point of view that some have about this, whether they're educated on the subjects or not, and that is, we look at documents like, let's say, the Magna Carta, 800 years old. Are we taking the document itself to be the upstanding law that we are to apply today as coming from that actual physical document, or are we just taking the principles and the concepts that come from that document? And the main point of that question is, people say, well, the Constitution in America, for example, it's old, it's outdated, it's irrelevant, we don't need that anymore. And I think they forget about the concepts that are embedded within it that actually matter. What are your thoughts on that? That it's just too old.
No, it's the substance of something, the spirit of something, and not the form it takes. It's like saying, you know, when people worship this figure, Jesus, and turn him into a cult figure, that it's not a matter of worshiping the image of something, but what is the substance of what he was saying. And it's a similar thing here. It's, as was said, this idea of ab initio, nothing is initiated by man when it comes to these fundamental freedoms. And liberties, they are born in us and cannot be taken away from us. When it says in the U.S. Constitution, Congress shall enact no laws that subvert these basic liberties, you know, freedom of speech, the whole bit, they're declaring something that just is. We're not just making this stuff up. It's a simple fact that you cannot take away somebody's liberty. It's impossible. It's like the notion even of property. What is property? It's this mental construct we've created on the earth, where one group of people can own it and others can't, when it's given to us all freely by the Creator. So, you know, we got to get outside the illusion of these mental illusions foisted on us to the real substance of something. We're just enacting something that's already there. So Magna Carta is one expression of it, just like the U.S. Constitution was, just like the work we're doing is, but it's the thing behind it that counts, if you know what I'm saying.
I completely agree with you, and I also wanted to add in there with what you were saying. You can't necessarily take people's rights away, but perceptually you can. And the only way that you can do that is by getting people to consent to the tyrannical system that's in place. So you can't necessarily take people's rights away in terms of them being free people unless they give those rights up willingly. And a lot of people give those rights up willingly based on ignorance that they actually have them to begin with, because they are essentially bred from birth to believe that they don't have these rights and that they have privileges that are granted to them by the authority figures. And once again, that is why this work is so important in understanding history, so that we can understand the rights that we do have as free men today.
Okay, now just a final point before we bring Dan on, because I know he's waiting. You said they agree to these to the restriction of their liberties because they don't know any better. Well, under law, if you sign a contract or enter into an agreement on the basis of coercion or ignorance, the contract is null and void. In other words, just because you don't realize that, you know, agreeing with the authorities means you're going to be put in prison somewhere, that doesn't make it valid. Ignorance is nullifying a force as is coercion, somebody holding a gun to your head. So again, it's like, you know, it doesn't change the nature of something. Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am, yeah.
How are you, Dan?
Good, how are you guys doing?
We're good. We're just talking about Magna Carta. Good. And one of, you know, the next phase of the discussion, we wanted to very much talk about this project that I mentioned in the announcements, that we're wanting to convene a common law court into fraudulent taxation in Canada, and especially this agency, the Canada Revenue Agency. And one of the principles in Magna Carta is that liberties are inherent and are granted to everybody, and that in terms of an agency that operates, that violates those liberties, we have continual recourse to stand on that rather than statutes that set up something like Canada Revenue. So why don't we talk a little bit about, you know, that kind of idea that you had about setting up the court, and let's try to apply some of this Magna Carta discussion to how we in Canada here can use it to actually convene courts into these criminal bodies. Do you want to mention, you know, some of the things that, that led you to think we should do this case?
Well, most definitely. I think that the case against the CRA is extremely relevant to every member of the Republic and every Canadian simply that isn't even a member of the Republic. Most people don't realize that the CRA is a private corporation. It's an offshore corporation, so most of the time our tax dollars that we're paying are going into offshore investments, and our land trust in Canada is being eroded, and money's being taken from our trust to pay for our private services that we have. Our tax dollars don't actually go to any of the services that we are provided with, for the most part. And it's a private corporation as well, and so for some reason this private corporation thinks that they have the right to force anybody and everybody to pay them a tax. And if you don't pay this tax, this private corporation will show up at your house with guns. They'll throw you in jail. They'll seize your assets. They'll take your business. They'll take everything that you have to your name and hold you penniless in prison. You know, they're a private corporation. They're not even part of the government. That's no different than me having a Blockbuster card and forgetting to return the movie. The next thing I know, I have two guys in Blockbuster outfits standing outside my door with AK-47s, and they're going to inter me in the back storeroom at the Blockbuster until I pay my Blockbuster fees off. You know, it's completely asinine that a private corporation thinks that they can commit these kinds of crimes against the people. And it's time that we hold the CRA accountable for the crimes that they are committing and how they violate everybody's rights. And you're guilty until proven innocent. You have to prove that you're innocent. They automatically can say that you owe something and you owe it. There's no due process. There's no justice. There's no jury by trial. It's a complete, right. Everything they do is a complete violation of our rights.
Well, Dan, I realize that as you're talking, it sounds very much like the child apprehension system in the Children's Aid Society, in that exactly the same mentality and running roughshod over due process that goes on when they traffic children through Minister of Children and Families and whatever you want to call it. And it's that same sense that there's no you know, probable cause required in a case. All they have to say is, well, we think that kid's being abused. Go grab them. CAS makes $100,000 for every child they put in a foster home. It's big money. And so ultimately, we're dealing with this. We say, follow the money. Well, it leads us to the recognition of this criminality, right?
Oh, most definitely. And it's the same thing as the Children's Aid Society. All the CRA has to do is say that you owe them money, and you owe them money. All they have to simply do is say that you owe it. They don't have to prove it. You have to prove that you don't owe it.
Right. Now, let's talk a little bit. Ryan, do you have any comments or anything you want to just jump in anytime?
Well, I think that it absolutely ties in with Canadian revenue, the Internal Revenue Service in the United States, and globally, international banking as well, because once you have a nation in a substantial amount of debt, or you have people in a substantial amount of debt, get them to, I mean, you basically have got them as a slave. They become a slave at that point, what you might call a wage slave. So you go to work to make money, to pay taxes, to pay off that debt that just keeps accumulating in terms of interest, and that interest is made up, the money is made up, and these are all out. I mean, all the banks, all the big central banks all over the planet are established as an outside offshore banking cartel. And if you look at it from a large, large perspective, you can see that the different revenue agencies, the big banks, the drug running, and the child trafficking is all tied into the same major network. It's just very compartmentalized, but it does all tie into the same network. And really, I think no matter where you start in your research and understanding that, it will come around full circle and you'll see how it's all tied in together. But that's just my first initial comment.
Right, and it's amazing how all the
roads... Oh, I would have to agree with that 100%. Our banking system here in Canada, we only have $50 billion worth of printed money in Canada at any given time, and most of it's in circulation. And through fractional reserve lending, the banks have taken that $50 billion worth of printed money and they have loaned out $1.7 trillion off of it. So our banking system is completely fraudulent here in Canada as well. And it definitely ties into the crimes being committed by the CRA.
Right. And, you know, the one of the things that I wanted to mention to people as well, if you go to our the website of the Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State, you not only have a lot of proof showing the interlocked nature of these crimes and how a lot of them tend to lead to Rome. But there's a thing called the Community Common Law Training Manual at itccs.org. Just look in the right-hand column there. And in it, it lays out 12 steps to establishing a common law court. Now, one of the first things you do when you're adjudicating a case like what Dan's talking about against a suspected criminal body or individual, you need what's called a notice of claim of right. You've got to state clearly who the perpetrator is, the crime they've committed, and the relief that you're seeking, the kind of resolution you want. So for people who wanted to be involved in this case, Dan, what are some of the things that we would be naming as the, you know, besides the general, you know, problem of them ripping people off and acting in a completely dictatorial manner? What are some of the charges we would actually bring against CRA and its agents? Because there always has to be a human face on this. You can't charge a corporation in general. You have to name defendants. And this is, I wanted to kind of urge people to start thinking along those lines, because when we put the Pope and the others on trial, we had names. You know, the old saying, evil has an address and a face. There are people doing these crimes. There's civil servants in Ottawa issuing orders to CRA agents to, if necessary, defraud people to get their money and to use whatever means, including putting them in prison and that. We know that from people who have worked at CRA. They've seen letters to that effect coming from senior civil servants. So what are your thoughts on about all of that?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think that the list of crimes that are committed by the CRA could be extremely lengthy. They do exactly whatever they want. There's no accountability. They will lie through their teeth. They'll defraud you. They'll steal from you. They'll threaten you. I can't even list them all off now. I guess you have coercion. You have threats. You have theft. They'll seize your home. They'll seize your bank account. So theft. Basically all the charges that you'd see in a RICO trial in the States against a mobster. That's basically the indictments that you'd see coming down the pipeline to deal with the CRA, because they're nothing but organized criminals.
Right, and
yes,
there's
legal yet unlawful robbery is all that it is, keeping people in a state of servitude, giving them the illusion that they are free.
Now, there's a really, I wanted to flag this for you because this could be a helpful in the case. There's a term called premunire. That's premunire. You should look it up. It's in Old English law. It meant when the sovereign is acting at the behest of a foreign power, that's, even if it's a sovereign, anyone who does that is committing a crime against the people and can be brought to trial for it. Now, in this case, it was aimed at the fact that the Church of Rome was continually trying to take over the politics in England. And the offense of premunire was when the king was acting at the behest of the Pope, basically, to violate the laws of England. Well, there's so many governments now doing that when it comes to the Church of Rome. Look at how Obama's invited a convicted criminal, Pope Francis, to come and speak to the Congress. That is an act which traditionally could get Obama in very hot water and continue to fund this criminal body as well through taxation, you know, sending tax money to Rome through a thing called the Financial Concordat, which Canada also has. Your taxpayer money is funding a criminal syndicate in Rome that traffics children. And so that's some of the broader, I mean, under constitutional law and international law, you can also indict Canada for the fact that it's acting at the, it's ripping off its own citizens to help foreign corporate bodies, including the Vatican.
Oh, most definitely. I would 100% agree with you on that fact. I'm a little tongue-tied right now.
No, that's fine.
So what do people do about this? Withdraw consent from the system, stop paying taxes, and they have to do that in a mass grove. Otherwise, they face individual justice brought against them. Not real justice, of course, but what the system sees as justice. What do you think? I mean, what, do we have to just withdraw consent from that system?
That's step A. If I think there's two steps to this. You have to withdraw your support from the system, but the difficulty of that is that if you don't have anything to replace it, people are kind of left hanging there saying, well, what do I do now? I'm going to be prosecuted and there's nobody there to help me. That is often what holds people back. Step B is we not only withdraw support from the system, we create something to replace it. And so one of the things that this is very exciting, you know, I mentioned earlier the Constitutional Convention at the end of October in Toronto, where delegates are going to be establishing a constitutional framework for the Republic of Canada. One of the things that the organizing committee is doing is they're drafting a whole approach to local governments in Canada, town, you know, the mayor and town councils. And they're saying, look, here's a way that you can withdraw from the system. Keep the taxation money and the revenue in your community. So what we say to people is we set up republic banks, community banks in your community, and you keep your money there. You don't just take it out of Canada Revenue. You put it in there. And that gives us a war chest to operate with. Strategically, it's very good because it's giving some people something to do rather than simply individualistically saying, well, I'm not taking part anymore, which is a good first step, but we need to take it to the next step. So I wondered, you know, your thoughts on that, and let's kind of explore that whole direction a bit.
Well, I definitely think that that's one of the reasons that the case against the CRA is of such great importance. Is due to the fact that our legal system in Canada is still set up off of common law, though they do like to hide your access to accessing the common law. But commencing this case against the CRA, it'll set a precedent that will be able to be used in court when the CRA does come after anybody. They can use the precedent set by our court case against the CRA. So it could definitely help people when they do withdraw from the system. If the CRA or the government does come after them, they can start using the precedents, and then they can also turn around and use our court system that we've set up to then have their right. If their rights were infringed upon by the government, they can bring it into our court system, and we can rule on it as the people and hold the government accountable for the crimes that were committed against the people as well.
That's right.
Hey, so Kevin, I thought that you guys... Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead, Ron.
I was just going to tell a quick story about something that happened when I first got into radio that ties in with all this. I did a radio show at an old college radio station in Orlando. I had done it for about a year and a half. That's when I first started. And I came across this information about free man on the land, for example, sovereign citizens. So I did a little research into it. I found out all the details about it for the most part and my general understanding, and I did a show on it. My show was 2 hours long, and after that show was over, I got a call from the station manager, who was a pretty cool guy. He wasn't upset with me or anything, but he said he had got calls from, I guess, one of the people that called him was from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and they were threatening to sue the school if they didn't kick me off the air because they said that I was promoting an act of terrorism just by talking about the concept of it. Just thought that you might think that's interesting.
That's really common, and as a matter of fact, I guess I'd have to lock up all the founding fathers of America for using the same words. Sovereignty just means you're not under anybody's jurisdiction. And, of course, no government likes that. No banker likes that. They've got to keep you in debt and in slavery. And all of these ideas are a threat to that. So, you know, it's no accident that Thomas Jefferson said, if this country is to survive, it will need a revolution every 20 years. He said that just before his death, and it's true. That's all we're doing. There's another thing I wanted to flag from what Dan was saying, and that is that when we start taking these actions, you hear this term, it's not legal. And again, Ryan, I wanted your take on this too, because the power of words. Look at the origin of the word legal. It's the same word, the root of that word is the same as the word religion, legio. What legio means is to tie together, to bind together. So like religion binds people together, not in the name of God, but just as an organization. Everybody's part of the same mindset and group, religion. Legio was, in terms of legality, it means you're bound to a system. And in ancient Rome, there was a thing called the imperial legate. And a legate carried this white stick around and said, I'm speaking in the name of the emperor, and he had absolute authority to do whatever he wanted, bring in any law, kill anybody, whatever, absolute authority. Just like there's papal legates they send out, it's the same system. So legality really means we are tied into a system and you're a prisoner of it. So when we say, is this legal? No, of course it's not legal. We don't recognize your system. It's lawful. And, you know, so I wanted to say, you know, get both of your take on that. that's a word that's used against us to get everybody afraid. But no, things don't have to be legal to be right. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I agree with you. There's a huge difference between what is legal and what is lawful. First thoughts that come to my mind are, again, education. And the reason it seems nowadays, at least from my perspective, why people aren't aware of this and aren't taking, I mean, there's a lot of people that are waking up and understanding this within our movement and others. It just seems like there's a state of existence where people have felt as if the modern age we are in is void of all of these tyrannies. That's something you hear about in school. That's something you read about in a history book. That's something that you might watch in a movie about history or something like that. So we tend to be very complacent, thinking that we've reached some pinnacle of a utopia, in a sense, even if that's a subconscious reaction to the way that the world seems. So we don't want to fight back. We've become dependent upon systems of religion, systems of politics, dependent upon systems of food distribution. And we really have not been taught how to take care of ourselves. We've only been taught to rely on authority figures for that. And, of course, the language is very, very important, because if the language is restricted to a point, kind of like the story of the Tower of Babel, the spreading and the separation of languages so people can't communicate, that creates a state of servitude. And the more people are unable to communicate, just like the elimination of certain words in the dictionary in George Orwell's 1984, that is very symbolic of what's happening today, as we can see our language beginning to break down, where people don't speak with, hello, how are you doing today? It's more like, hey, what's up? And that continues to get broken down more and more and more, abbreviations and LOLs and hi. You know, I actually know people that instead of laughing, they say LOL. That's the state that we're in now, where people have become dumber and dumber and dumber. But go ahead, I'll rant all day.
No, but, you know, this is in the last 12 minutes or so, I do want to kind of bring this back to the work we're doing now, because one of the things, Dan, when you were talking, was traditionally in England, the sheriff, and of course in America you have these guys that are elected by the community, but we don't have them in Canada, of course, but the sheriff, his job was not only to keep the peace, and he could even convene courts in the local shires or the towns, he was also the chief tax collector. So one of the things we're doing, if you go to CanadaRepublic.ca, Dan, when you're talking about setting up courts, our court system, they need protection, and they need common law peace officers. There's a whole training manual there at CanadaRepublic.ca. I really urge everyone to read it, the Sheriff Training Manual. It tells you a bit about how we need this, our own law enforcement. And one of the jobs the sheriffs could do, if we're talking about shifting back power to the local community and getting mayors and town councils on board with this, is we train and elect competent local sheriffs, and their job would be to keep the funds and the taxation in the community. And when the CRA agents come to town, arrest those bastards, put them on trial, let the CRA know that they're going to be arrested if they come into our communities. This is how we start shifting power back, taking power back in our hands, reclaiming our nation. It's got to happen that way in the grassroots, as well as talking about the big stuff here. So what are your thoughts on about that, and maybe some of the next steps in this for folks who are listening?
Well, I would definitely say that some of the next steps that we need to look at is getting more involvement from members right across the Republic who are interested in this case and have a vested interest in it. We're going to need people to help set up the case. We're going to need citizen jurors, and the more jurors the better. We need to have at least 12 jurors to convene this court case, but by all means, if we could have every member of the Republic want to act as a juror, that would be phenomenal. So basically, we need all of our members who are listening into the radio show today, and or know anybody else who hasn't signed on to the Republic yet that's interested, to tell them that we're looking to set up, that we're launching this case against the CRA, and we need as much public involvement as possible to get the wheels rolling on this so that we can do exactly what you had just said there, fight them and keep the tax dollars in our communities and set up our own. This all needs to be done at the local level, as far as I'm concerned. Approaching your city council and having them adopt the court system of the Republic and
disavow the oath of
work at the local level.
Yeah, disavow their oath of allegiance to the crown. That's kind of first step.
Oh, most definitely. That's most definitely the first step.
Right, and so I know that you have your own email. I don't know if I got it right. Do you want to tell folks how to reach you if they want to work on this campaign, especially in London area?
Yeah, it's LondonDirectActionGroup@gmail.com. And any member of the Republic can feel free to email me at that address. My name's Dan, as you all know. So feel free if you'd like to get involved in any way or any capacity at all that you can help. Just send me an email and I'll get back to you as promptly as possible.
We're also making an appeal, too, to any employee of the Canada Revenue Agency, anyone in the system who has information on the fraudulent criminal actions of CRA, hard evidence. We need documents, we need things in writing, and people willing to give testimony in the court. And so this is all...
Anybody who comes forward will be granted amnesty for sure.
Absolutely. So this is, again, part of the whole thing. Now we have... Magna Carta, I think, is an inspiration at the end of the day. It's not a... We know the way tyranny acts. It doesn't matter what kind of piece of paper you're waving in front of them, they can laugh at you. So this Magna Carta, if you like, has to live in our hearts, it like anything real, and then manifest it in our actions. That's the only way to make it real. Like when you're saying, people, Ryan, when you're saying earlier that people believe we're in some kind of better state now, there is no democracy. There is nothing until we make it happen by our actions and our lives. It's never just given to us.
So no, these rights are never given to us. It's no different than the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta, John II didn't give the rights to the barons. The barons had to march on London and take London Tower before he listened to their demands and allowed them to voice their concerns about wanting natural law to be their rights. He wasn't just going to give it away. People had to march and demand it. They had to take London Tower to do so.
That's true. I forgot to mention that in the historical lead-up to this. The barons had marched on London and seized the entire city, and John was losing his kingdom. He had his back to the wall. So force came first, then the talk. So let's keep that in mind. Ryan, you were going to say something.
One comment, and then I have a question for you that maybe you and I haven't discussed, but maybe it's a common question other people might be thinking about. The first comment I have is that I guess the core of the Magna Carta, the conceptual idea of it, could really stand as a principle baseline, as a foundational core for the work that we're doing in common law, I think. And the question I have is, in terms of setting up a Congress and in terms of setting up the Republic of Canada, has anybody ever asked you about military? Do you need a military in establishing this new country? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's I'll let Dan answer that too, but in the original constitutional draft, there said yes, of course. But the way it's being conceived in the discussion going on now across the country is not a standing army, but a citizen's militia, whereby everybody takes responsibility, just like they have to for the law and liberty generally. You have to take responsibility for the policing and the protection of your communities. So we're not talking about a new army. We're talking about a new kind of army, where all the citizens are armed and all the citizens protect themselves and their children and their land. That's right in Article, in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the right to bear arms. That's not advocating violence. That's being realistic that we have to defend ourselves. And so, absolutely, and, that's going to be debated at the convention at the end of October, that whole thing. Dan, what do you think?
Well, I definitely have to agree with what you said there. And one thing to point out about having a citizens' militia like that is that it's the only thing throughout history that has ever kept a tyrannical government in check is an armed citizen. It's like where the citizens have the right to bear arms. That is the only thing that will keep a government in check, because if the government controls all the guns and are the only people with the guns, it isn't long before they turn them on the citizens.
That's a sensitive issue in Canada, because I know growing up, quote, Canadian, we were always taught, well, the reason there's so much violence down in the States is everybody's got a shotgun in the back of their pickup truck, right? And it's kind of like us Canadians, we trust the police. They'll protect us, which is fallacy, because you're usually shot by the police, especially if you're native or poor. But, exactly right. And so I don't know if that answers your question, Ryan, but it's very important that we talk about that as well.
Yeah, I agree too. Citizen militias, people being armed, you know, they try to turn it around and make it seem as if all the people that have guns, those are the ones causing the violence. So let's eliminate gun ownership. Let's eliminate people's ability to obtain weapons. And while I may agree that some people can use weapons for different, you know, guns for various malevolent purposes, you know, I could just as well take a steak knife and go at somebody with it. I mean, you can turn anything into a weapon. Eliminating guns doesn't do anything except eliminate people's ability to readily protect themselves against the real criminals, because when people give up their guns, lawfully or legally, whatever you want to call it, who keeps the guns? The people that are not doing things under the law. And then you have no ability to protect yourself from the criminals. And that's the whole part of the system is run by criminals, and that's why it's set up that way.
Now, don't forget, we're not aligning ourselves politically with the NRA or any of these other groups that kind of milk
that
mentality, and they're tied into the arms industry. No, we're not talking about that. Violent, and I think it's part of the bigger question, and maybe we should end on this because we've only got a few minutes left, but it's a bigger question of taking back society. And the fact of being able to defend yourself is a sign that we're also using the law. We are becoming the nation, because up till now we've been brainwashed to be passive and allow other people to do it for us. Once we take back and reclaim control, we're reclaiming everything, including the protection of our community. So that's very important. And it's a very practical question too, because once we establish these courts, we need to protect those courts. And there's an old quote from one of the guys in Ireland who fought for the Republic against England back in 1916. He said, "What created our republic was once we established our Brehon language courts under Gaelic law. We set up our own courts alongside the Crown courts, just like we're doing right here in Canada. And once we set up the courts, we had to defend those courts in arms against the British Army. Once we did that, we were a nation. We had our own laws and we had the means to protect ourselves. And you need those two things if we're going to take this step. And we are taking this step." So I just wanted to point that out. Any final words from either of you guys?
Well, I think a really important thing to point out with that fact is that having an armed wing of the Republic as a military is that it's not like we're going to take the country over with force. I think that's something we need to point out that we're not condoning at all. It's to protect our legal system, protect the residents of Kanata. That would be the reason for having an
that's
armed
right.
military.
And in fact, the more people we get on board, the less it's necessary to use force. We're appealing to the police and the soldiers to disavow their oath of allegiance to that criminal in London and take a new oath of allegiance to the people. Ryan?
Right. It's just a matter of us being able to protect ourselves in the case that we might need to, which is why we would have to have those militias in the first place. My last comments are just basically that today was very informative. I love that we were able to talk about the Magna Carta and the importance of the core principles of it. And I think that maybe once a week for all the listeners out there, maybe there's some who just tune into the show. They don't really know much more about what we talk about. You know, just take a couple of minutes a week, do a little research online, go to the library, something like that. Learn about history and learn how you can apply those historical events, historical documents to the modern day. You don't have to hold onto the Magna Carta and say, hey, let's follow this right now. You can just use it as a template for forming a new system as we are doing with the work that we have. So I just want to make that last comment.
Ryan, thank you. And I'll be on your show this Wednesday. Do you want to just announce that?
Yeah, actually, we'll be recording Wednesday. It won't be live, but you'll be on show this next Sunday on one of the big networks, LNM. And my website is thesecretteaching.info, and we'll be talking about the TRC. It starts at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. secretteachings.info. You can find all the links for the show there.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, Dan, for coming on again. And for everyone listening, tune in again next week. And we'll be at 6 p.m. Eastern time here at BBS Radio. And also follow our work, kanatarepublic.ca. This is an ongoing discussion. We'll be talking more and more about this leading up to the Constitutional Convention in Toronto on October 30th to November 1st. Plan to be there. You can come as a delegate. Just take out citizenship and take the oath of allegiance to the Republic of Canada. We thank you all. Until then, stay strong, brothers and sisters.
There's a man walking around the island with a snake cane. Picked it up in Thailand.